And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. You know, it is really great to come to you every Sunday or Monday, or if you're listening to the podcasts on SoundCloud or iTunes or at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. I love doing these programs, love having our guests in studio if we can get them on the phone via Skype. I don't care. Whatever way, if we have to go on remote, years ago went down to Marina Del Rey and sat in the lower deck of a yacht and interviewed, it was a Marissa Russo, the forensic healer, and that was great fun. But I love doing these programs, talking to you about all these different subjects, and we certainly hope that you enjoy it as well. And we also encourage you to go to our guest website. We will be telling you about that website here shortly to find out more as well. And we encourage you to continue your investigation, to continue your research into in all that is about our guests and their subject and so forth. And today is no exception. Today we have a local guest. Well, he's going to be local for a little while longer anyway. We hope that he will come back and visit us on a regular basis just the same. Or maybe we just may come down to L.A. and visit him. We're talking about the author as well as, and you refer to yourself as a mystic.
A mystic, yes.
Rosetto is our guest. It's great to have you in studio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Richard.
And I know we won't go into the details, but I know you're moving down to Los Angeles, and you're not going to be that far away. So I get down there every so often, too. So maybe I'll bring my recording equipment. We'll get together and maybe go out to Huntington Beach and sit on the wharf and chat some more about a lot of the subjects we may talk about here on this program. You also have a book. How long has this been out and available?
You know, the first edition of that book came out in the fall of 2013. And about a year ago, I let the second edition come out.
We're talking about Living the Paradox of Enlightenment, Spiritual Awakening in Simple, Clear English. Now, when you talk about the paradox of enlightenment, it makes me think, of course, of the Buddha. And the best way I can paraphrase it is that he finally got to the Bodhi tree, sat down, and realized, if I stop looking for it, I'll find it.
Yes, there's a genuine, sincere curiosity that lacks any urgency is a nice posture to hold. If you have that urgency,
it's hard.
Yes,
it's hard because you think, if I've got to have all those books,
yeah.
I've got to seek out that ancient wisdom. I've got to seek out those gurus and those avatars and on and on and on.
And you give yourself a lot of homework. You think
exactly.
You have to read a lot of books. And some people do read a lot of books, but I didn't.
And yet, you call yourself a mystic. Why?
A mystic is someone who sees God in everything. That's just a simple way of looking at it. There's no real standard definition of a mystic. But I've always had this feeling that if God is the creator, then what did he or she or it create from, but only from itself? So God is emanating as all of creation.
All right. So as a mystic, you see God everywhere. Do you always?
I think so.
Okay.
And if I ever catch myself going, ooh, you know, you can look at the emotional play within you. And if you see any kind of hatred or some kind of spike in an emotion that feels uncomfortable, you always ask yourself, I always ask myself, what am I missing here? You know, could this be God? You know, so a mystic will say that God is arising as everyone and God is doing everything.
So let's take a couple of examples. Would you say, were you able to see God, for example, in the Thomas Fire?
Oh, yes. Even though the Thomas Fire presented many different personal experiences to all the people in the community, tremendous heartbreak, people losing their loved ones, people losing their houses, people losing the cars, people losing their lifestyle, you know, a lot of loss, a lot of broken heart. And when you open up to the possibility that those broken hearts are God unfolding, and that broken heart is a precious thing to witness. Myself personally had a very easy experience in the Thomas Fire. I evacuated right when they suggested it. And I happened to have people nearby that said, come here and you can stay here and we'll cook a hot meal for you and you can sleep on the couch or whatever, you know. And things just went smoothly for me. And then, as you know, after the fire was over, there was a flood. And I had only just come back to that particular spot when, just days later, they said, mandatory evacuation for flood warning. And I said, you know, I think the house is going to be okay. I just rent a little tiny place, but I still was concerned about the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I think the house is going to be okay, but I'm not so sure about infrastructure, electrical, roads. And that, of course, is where a lot of trouble did come. But I was able to leave early, and people said, sure, come and stay with us, you know. And so I did, and it was all very smooth for me.
Yeah. I know that for myself, my wife, we've been here for 12 years. We've been through probably as many fires, and we were only evacuated in 2017 at the time of the Whittier fire up on the pass.
Yeah.
And we went and stayed at three different hotels, and then we had the offer of someone opening up their home to us, which was wonderful. We were very grateful for that. But I actually looked at the whole experience not only as a working staycation, but also as an opportunity to maybe write some reviews for some of these hotels that I would never stay in otherwise, you know, just trying to sort of put a positive spin on all of it, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there is no question it is unnerving, because much of what you think you need every day, you start to realize that you don't.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of amazing that it takes those kinds of experiences to realize that, yeah, maybe I don't need all of that stuff that's in that closet over there, or that cupboard, or that storage unit over there across the road, kind of thing. And we do tend to collect a lot of stuff externally, but we also collect a lot of stuff internally that kind of gets in the way of our ability to maybe process in such a way that is, I'm not sure exactly if this is the right phrasing, but maybe in the most positive way. Or the most beneficial, maybe that's a better way to put it, rather than this whole process of grieving and mourning. Loss of life, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's a very deep subject, because those broken hearts only come about because you really love that person.
Mm-hmm.
So in my book, I talk about people losing their pets, because I didn't want to go into something as personal as losing your spouse or something like that. But if someone has their dog pass away and they have that broken heart, there's still a richness to that. And you can take some of that from the wisdom of knowing, well, this broken heart is appropriate. This is the way I should be feeling, because there was so much richness in that love that I shared. And although it's gone now, it's not really gone forever, but it's gone in the form of the physical body of the animal being there with you, the loving animal, who really, these animals really do love you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're going through a period of time right now where we have a 16-year-old shepherd. I've talked to her a lot about on this program. And she's 16, but she can't walk.
Yeah.
I have to carry her everywhere she goes. I ended up hurting my back carrying her in probably not the best of ways. I've come up with another new, better way that my back is doing much better. Thank you. And yet at the same time, it's like, okay, when do you say when? You know, and people talk about quality of life, and I understand that too.
Yeah,
and
I get that too.
And it's like, you know, even I am sitting here watching this dog going, this isn't the dog's life. Mm-hmm. What are we doing to her? Mm-hmm. And yet she still has that love in her eyes and that spark, and she's still eating and drinking, and you know, she's wearing diapers because obviously the systems are still functioning. I've been told that, oh, you know, there's going to come a point where there are some other things that are going to start happening and you may have to consider. And I hope we don't ever get there.
Maybe she will tell you.
Yeah, well, that's what my wife says. She says, let's wait for Makushla. She'll tell us. She'll tell us when it's time. You know, and I keep thinking, I wish you'd hurry up and tell us, because even my wife has told me that she says, I don't want to do that because it's an inconvenience to us.
Yeah.
And I understand that. And at the same time, you know, you wonder, I mean, like I said, I think I did injure my back lifting her. And I think, how much longer can this go on? My back can't take much more. Well, I've got to come up with new ways of helping her and assisting her and so forth. But anyway, it's because of the connection that we have with her and the relationship and the time that we've spent with her and the work that she has done through her life as a caregiver. She has been a caregiver. She took care of an elderly Siberian Husky before his passing, and at his passing, she was right there.
That's nice.
She cared for and raised a Shepherd Chow pup that we brought with us from Phoenix until his passing, and he unfortunately died of a snake bite. And then she has raised our current 5-year-old King Shepherd, Angus. She raised him from 8 weeks and mothered him and taught him everything he knows, in essence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's like, okay, it's our turn to care for her. And you may be right. She will let us know, you know.
Yeah, and just have faith that nothing will be asked of you that's beyond your capacity.
Yeah.
Like we touched on earlier before we went on air, the ability to do what you need to do when you need to do it.
And let's talk a little bit about that, because we actually did talk a lot about that before we even started. Maybe we should have started a lot earlier in the recording.
It's good.
But we were talking, of course, about abundance and prosperity. And, of course, I shared the story about, and I won't go into it here because I've shared it before on the program. So you'll have to search through the interviews, folks, to find the whole story. But the bottom line is that I could have gone one of two different directions, psychologically or mentally, as far as abundance and prosperity in a particular job. You know, I could have gone down the road of, they don't pay me enough, so I'm going to start pilfering. You know, I'm going to start taking this and that and the other thing because I'm justified because they don't pay me enough. Or I could go down the other road that I did go down. I'm going to receive compensation, but it's not going to be through the sources that I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we were sharing this, you quoted that phrase that you just stated, in reference to this whole aspect of the lilies of the field.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I'll talk about the lilies in just a sec. I just want to make clear that the that statement I made about the ability to do what you need to do when you need to do it comes from Bashar, as channeled by Daryl Anka. So that's not original with me. And also, when it comes to the lilies of the field, of course, we read about this in the Bible. And here we have God saying to people, don't worry about what you wear. Don't worry about what you eat. Know that God will take care of you as he takes care of the lilies of the field. And I think I was just a little boy when I heard that. And I was so joyous to hear that God was going to take care of me. And I've never let go of that belief that God takes care of me. Now, let's look at it in a little bit bigger picture. We're not saying that God is going to keep the lilies in pristine state the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It is the big picture that God takes care of everything. So the lilies will grow and become more beautiful and then finally pristine and then finally deteriorate and decompose. And then they'll reintegrate into the soil and be born again. And it is in through this entire process that God takes care of not only the lilies, God takes care of you, God takes care of everything.
Yeah.
So you just want to look at where you fit in, where your job is, and let God take care of God's job. And so that we touched on the serenity prayer.
Yeah.
Yeah. God grant me the serenity. You go ahead with that prayer.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change.
Accept the things I cannot change.
Change
the courage to change the things I can.
And the wisdom to know the difference. Yeah.
And so this puts it all in place. And so whenever I'm in a log jam going, gee, I really want to solve this problem, but I don't seem to have the tools, I just remind myself, oh, this is a problem that God is going to solve.
Yeah. But we are going to be used to
exactly.
solve the problem.
You are an instrument.
We have to be in position, if you will.
I like that.
To
posture.
Be used.
Mm-hmm.
I've loved the phrase, do not become part. Do not try to control the process, become part of the process. You know, meaning you become the tool that's going to be used by the universe. And to that end, the way that we know is by listening to our intuition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the next level.
Exactly. And so this voice of intuition is always loud enough, but sometimes there's some clutter from your, what you might call, a selfish-oriented lower mind. I need this. I need that. It's got to look like this. You know, I'm not going to do it unless it's going to construct what I have in mind. But when you realize that what you have in mind might not really be what God has in mind, and you let go of your picture of what things are going to look like when you're done working on it, and just go, I don't know what it's going to look like, but this is what I'm called to do, and this is what I have the capacity to present right now, to engage in right now, in a loving and kind way, and just pursue that and see what unfolds.
You know, this, I often refer to what we're conversing about as the ancient wisdom teachings.
Of course.
And, of course, we can go back to a lot of what has been written over the millennia that is still available to us, fortunately. And at the same time, I love the one quote that truth is only truth until it's written down. Because as soon as it's written down, guess what happens? We start to dissect it and debate it and try to determine what's meant by it, you know, or what was meant by the writers thereof. I was sharing with you earlier that I used to have an opportunity to do interviews at the religious station, and I actually had a gentleman who channeled the Apostle Paul, who instructed him to write another book, the explanation of the epistles of Paul to the various churches around the area at the time following Christ's crucifixion. And we kind of, it's like the explanation of the explanation. It's like, would you please get it? I'm tired of writing these explanations kind of thing.
Well, what we have here is this deep truth really presents itself in an intuitive fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It does not come about strictly through observation and logic. And what this has set up for some groups is some tension between the logical mind and your intuition. But what I'd like to put on the table is that these two things, the logical mind and your intuition, are actually best friends.
Mm.
They have different jobs,
right?
But they're best friends.
Yeah.
And as false ideas are removed from your mind and you integrate in more true ideas, this opens you up to intuition. And as this intuition flows into you, it brings forth more true ideas. And you articulate this truth clearer and clearer. And this opens you up yet more to the intuition. So these are like two hands, each hand washing the other. So let go of any idea that your logical mind is in some kind of a battle with your intuition or your heart.
Mm-hmm.
They work all together. God created you the way that you are because you need all these things. And if you let go of the idea that there's going to be some kind of internal conflict, you can go ahead and flow without having any of these stuck points come up because you go, oh, it's all going to flow together.
Mm. Well, I also struggle from time to time with the concept of from the ancient wisdom teachings, we learn where we come from, the One.
Mm-hmm.
We also learn where we're going to, the One. And that we also learn about where we are, the dualistic world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Why? Why are we doing this to ourselves? We know where we've been. We know where we're going. Why don't we just go there and be done with this dualistic philosophical conundrum that we face maybe time and time and time again? You know, there may not be an answer to that question just simply because, well, guess what? This is where we are. End of story. Okay. There is no further explanation. This is just where we are. Okay. And it's a dualistic world. At the same time, when I start looking at the macrocosm, the cosmos, and I start looking at what goes on in the universe, you see things hurtling through space, right? And sometimes colliding into one another, and explosions, and this and that and the other thing, right? We would look at that as human beings in our maybe our logical mind or maybe in our emotions. Oh, look at the chaos. The universe doesn't look at it that way. The universe looks at it as, this is just the universe working. This is just the way the universe is. It just is. There is no dualism. There is no right or wrong or good or bad. It just is. That's the way it functions. What are you going to do? You know? You can't stop the meteors from hurtling through, and you can't stop the planets from spinning around the stars, and you can't stop the stars from going supernova, because that's what they do. That's just what they do. You know, there's so you can't put a judgment on the universe saying it's controlled chaos. It's not chaos. It's like to me, I look at our natural world. We talked earlier about, you know, the various animals that we've seen and come in contact with, and the lives that they live are just the lives that they live. They don't look at anything as good or bad. Oh my God, I'm predator or I'm prey. I'm predator. That's not good. I'm predator. That's great. And I'm prey. Oh, that's not so good. No, it's just life. That's just the way that it is. There's no dualism there.
You put quite a bit on the table here. I have an essay up on my website called Why We Call It Non-Dual Wisdom.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was looking at.
And so in there, the first thing I put on the table is this definition that God and creation are one reality, mm-hmm. not two. Mm-hmm. This is why we say it. We use the word non-dual. God and creation are one reality, not two. Again, God is emanating as this creation. Now, when it comes to dualistic expressions, you know, hot and cold, and other things like this, a coin with two sides,
yeah,
male and female. What I like to say is that the world contains many dualistic expressions. I don't say that the world itself is dualistic, because the world also contains multiplicity. There's you and me and him and her and all of this uniqueness, lots of multiplicity. But there are certainly these things that arise in a dualistic fashion. And what we notice about them is that they just arise. And we can ask ourselves the question as they arise, is this what I prefer? And if the answer is no, sometimes there's an interjection of hatred. This is really where things get to be sticky, because you can work on making things what you prefer without hating it. And this is the part about emotionally accepting it mm-hmm. without hating. Mm-hmm. So if you see war or things in the world and you go, you know, this is not what I prefer. I'd like to work towards world peace, or perhaps on a smaller scale, just personal peace. Sometimes tension between a coworker or a friend or whatever. So you can say, I'm going to work on this without hating where it is right now, even though it's not what I want. So I'm going to engage and look for a cooperative path. How can I make this work? How can I find common ground and work towards that? So it's not that the mystic doesn't see dualistic expressions as valid. We see them, and we see them as they arise, and we accept them as they are. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to a moral code, good and evil, I think it can be helpful to have a functional moral code, because I'm going to work for what I think is good.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to hate those that choose to work other ways. In other words, some people work towards world peace through strength of the military or whatever, rather than perhaps looking for ways of cooperation. So there are different ways. In fact, for every person, there's a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that, of course, that's a huge challenge in and of itself when we're talking about finding those new ways of living and so forth, and creating a bigger problem when we talk about choices and knowledge of those choices to help make people's dreams come true. That I have always been all about having choices.
Yes.
The problem I have, though, with that issue of having choices is, when do you stop collecting choices? It's like going into a restaurant and they give you a phone book size menu and you don't even know where to start. But by the same token, I'd rather have that than no choice at all. You know?
Free will is a very interesting
question,
because a lot of people think that that word means that you have an infinite number of choices, or an infinite, unbounded. And what's really interesting, and I use the example in my book about a ukulele. A ukulele is a very limited instrument. It only has four strings. It's very small. It doesn't play very loud. It can only play so many notes. But guess how many songs you can play on a ukulele? An infinite number of songs can be played on this limited instrument. Mm-hmm. How paradoxical.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you are. You are an instrument in the hands of God. You as a person are only Richard. You can only do so much.
Mm-hmm.
You're limited.
Right.
And yet there is an infinite number of choices and an infinite number of ways that God can work through you.
Right. And I may not even know what they are.
In the moment,
yeah,
it'll arise and you go, oh, yeah. This looks good to me now, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes if you would have known more about the future and how it would have turned out, you'd go, you know, the benefits that came from that, I'm going to ignore. I'm looking at the trouble that came from it, and I would not have picked that path.
Right.
And there are many paths in my life where I was like, boy, if I would have known that this road was going to be this difficult, I'd have stayed in the easy chair.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, to take a look at that from a different perspective, I've never believed in wasted time. I've had jobs down through the years that weren't radio related, broadcast related, that others might say, well, yeah, but that's taking you away from your first love, and that has nothing to do with what you're doing there. It says, well, that's not necessarily true.
It must have something to do with it.
Exactly. And it may have had more to do with giving me a respite.
Yeah.
To think about what I really wanted to do next than training me with some skill that I was going to take to the next level.
Again, the logical, linear, logical mind trying to plan it all out.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've got intuition going on over here, too, saying, well, what about this over here? You know, it's like, don't worry about how it bolts together. Just go ahead and go with the flow. Or as I like to say, and I'm stealing this from someone from the 80s, glow with the flow. And I don't remember who I first heard that from, but glow with the flow, because you are glowing as you're joyous, as you're in this loving state, as you're in this peaceful state. So glow with the flow. Yeah.
And it's also very important for each one of us, you know, because we're given that opportunity. We're given those impressions from that still small voice, our intuition, what have you. Most of the time, it's specifically and exclusively for us. And I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, Thomas, I just got a message for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It doesn't work quite like that. But how it does work is, and this is along the lines of what James Redfield wrote about in Celestine Prophecy, about how we each have messages for one another. And they may not be, oh, Thomas, here's my message for you.
Ah.
Okay. And where's my message from you?
Yeah. The envelope says,
exactly.
It's got your name.
Exactly.
No, envelope.
It doesn't work that way.
No envelope.
But what we need to do is we need to be sharing with one another, because to deny the other person the opportunity to continue to build the puzzle piece, to fill out the picture, the big picture that is their life, we are denying them that opportunity by not giving them the message in whatever form it might take. And vice versa. We are denying ourselves that ability to start filling in the pieces to better understand who we are and what our role is. And again, the big picture, when we refuse to accept the message from others. I had an experience just recently, and I've been meaning to share this because it was actually rather profound. From the standpoint that I thought, this is part of the problem that we're facing in our country, in particular these days. But I ran into this in the 80s as well, when I was working for the religious radio station. I received some information regarding an author and a book. And this gentleman, who is a pastor, he's a Christian pastor, wrote a book, and the book is entitled Healing the Nation. And it's based upon 2 Chronicles 7:14. My people who are called by my name, if they'll humble themselves and turn from their wicked ways, etc., etc., etc. And I was really looking forward to the interview. I thought it would be fascinating to get his take on how he wanted to see this country change and grow and prosper and become better than it is today. You know, because there's always room for, we would agree, there's always room for improvement, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so I was really looking forward to it. And then I get an email from the PR saying he's declined your interview because he saw your website.
Oh.
And the quote from him was that he has some really bizarre stuff. God, his words, bizarre stuff, God, almost as an expletive. I thought that was kind of odd. And refuses to do an interview with me because of the fact that you and I are talking about very broad things that are not within the framework of his belief system, you know, and that I've talked with people about for, well, God, I'm almost 40 years, but this show over 10. And I was really kind of disappointed. You know, and, you know, there's a part of me that's going, well, you know, if he were to take me up on it, I don't know that I'd do it now, because I'm concerned that one of my first questions would be of a very logical and literal nature about the very passage that he is using to bolster his argument. You know, I told a woman, I said, I would never attack him, but I might challenge his assumptions and his assertions.
Yeah.
Who are God's people? That's an Old Testament passage. Who is the Old Testament written to? It wasn't to the Christians, because they didn't exist. It was written to the Jews, right? Mm. So my people are the Jews, the nation of Israel, who are called by my name, Yahweh, if they will humble themselves and, you know, and so on and so forth. Well, I'm not included. I'm not a Jew. Although, then I would take it to the next level. If I was going to follow Jesus, who was a Jew, never converted to Christianity, I'd be a Jew who believes in Jesus. Mm-hmm. Okay? I mean, it just would stand to reason. All right? So then maybe I might slip under the door that way. But, you know, I'm thinking, I don't know. But here's someone who has basically chosen not to share their message. And yet, we don't know who's listening. We never know who's listening.
Yeah.
I'd like to believe somebody is listening.
Yeah.
And would you agree that the people who need to hear a given message are going to be listening at the right time?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is, your position right at that moment is, do you now pound your fist on the table and insist that he be on the show? No, of course not, because the flow is going to say, he gets to be who he is.
Exactly.
And you want to be enthusiastic in supporting him being who he is, and knowing, and this is a core belief that a lot of people don't have, the health of the individual is going to lead to the health of the group.
Yeah.
Some people think that the individuals are going to be sacrificed so that the group can be the best they are.
Yeah.
This is nonsensical, because when you trust that the individual does come forward, you're going to find a loving human being. This is our natural state. We are not naturally selfish. We are not naturally mean or fearful.
Yeah.
We're naturally trusting and curious and enthusiastic. And you see it in children when they're in a healthy environment.
Mm-hmm.
When they're not in a healthy environment, you see other things. You might see their fear. But mostly, if you give a child nurturing support, they're going to love you. They're not going to love you in response. They're going to love you because that's who they are. They're not going to be afraid. They're going to be curious.
Yeah.
And they want you to be who you are. And it's not like, oh, wait a minute, you're not fitting the mold that I have for you, or you're not the Xerox of who I am. No, no need for Xeroxing. No need for molds. Let God just flow through everyone and trust that it's going to be the best for the group and the individuals.
Yeah.
You're going to bring out the most love, the most kindness.
Exactly. It kind of like goes along with a question that was asked of me by my general manager back in Phoenix after doing an interview. He had to hear it because there was some controversy over it. The first question out of his mouth was, are you a Muslim? I said, no, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand. You know, I wish that I spoke or could read Arabic. I wish that I knew the Quran so that I would better understand what's going on. And I've even read some information in that regard, that the Quran is as literal and figurative and metaphorical and spiritual as is the Bible. I mean, it flows from one to the other, and you have to have somebody. You literally do have to have somebody who understands that to take you through it, because you really can't quite do it on your own. Although I suppose our intuition could lead us, but the point being that we choose not to make the effort to understand. And we say, I don't understand it, so it must not be any good.
Yeah, and sometimes the effort is a really slow pondering. It isn't a real fast dynamic check.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
I see point one. I'm not sure how point one leads to point two. I'm going to put an X by there. Sometimes you just have to hold it, especially when these have these intuitive understandings. You know, when you say that you exist fundamentally as pure awareness. Whoa, it's like I had to hold that for many months before I was even getting the idea of what my mentor was trying to tell me, because it was so different from the way I normally think. We think of ourselves as bodies, usually functioning in the world.
Yeah.
And then we have another definition that we are a soul, that we are fundamentally a soul.
Yeah.
But to be told that you exists fundamentally as pure awareness. It's like, wow, what does that really mean? And that's, as I put it, your fundamental identity, pure awareness. And yet you arise in a non-fundamental way, in a non-essential way. You arise as the totality of created reality. Mm. Whoa, this is a real mystical view. And then there's also the identity of the functional self, who you are as a person. So those are the three identities I talk about, the fundamental identity of being pure awareness, the non-fundamental or non-essential identity of being the totality of created reality, and the functional identity of being the person. Mm.
Living the paradox of enlightenment, spiritual awakening in simple, clear English. Thomas Rossetto is our guest here on the program. And we encourage you also to go to infinitelymystical.com and check out more of Thomas's writings. And we are going to continue talking with Thomas here on the program. Tell me your story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we do ask you to come up to the table that we have set forth. As we say many, many times on the program, we've laid out this smorgasbord. We're not asking you to try everything.
Nope.
Would never ask you to do that. I wouldn't want to do that. There are some things I've seen on a smorgasbord table. I don't think I want to try that. That does not look too appetizing. But we ask you to maybe try a little. If it doesn't resonate with you, as we say, don't touch it. Stay away from it. It may resonate with you tomorrow after you've had what was next to it that you do like, that does resonate with you. And again, it is a progression. You know, we don't get it all at once. Because if we did, I think, as the gurus have taught us, you'd fry. It'd fry you, literally fry you. You'd burn up.
That's what's so interesting about this path of exploring this wisdom. It remains functional. If you ever run into a space or an understanding that starts to take away your functionality, mm-hmm. then you know there's probably a misstep there. Maybe you're following a translation that isn't really very helpful.
Yeah.
So always look for functionality and always look for a loving heart. If you keep those two things in mind, you'll have good guiding lights.
Absolutely. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
AM 12. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thanks so much for staying with us as we continue talking with Thomas Rossetto. He is a mystic, and he has a book out, if you're interested in checking that out as well. It's called Living the Paradox of Enlightenment, Spiritual Awakening in Simple, Clear English, and also the website Infinitely Mystical. We encourage you to go to that website. He has a number of articles that he's written. The Living Heart of Enlightenment is one of them,
heart.
As well as, I beg your pardon, The Loving Heart. Misread that.
The
Loving Heart of Enlightenment. And of course, we also talked a little bit about the ancient wisdom. It's sometimes called non-dual wisdom. Just a couple of things. There's also a definition of enlightenment, which we probably have touched upon a little bit here throughout the program as well. And we encourage you certainly to check out his work. Anything in the works in the near future, as far as aside from the blogs, like a sequel to, so to speak, the Living the Paradox?
You know, I'm not the type of author that has a list of books that are going to be coming out. I reread my book, and I sometimes refine it and release a new edition. And I did that about a year ago. I released the second edition of the book, but I also just released a new version of that just about a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the book continues to mature, and the language becomes clearer and clearer. And I also integrate that up into the essays that are up on the website. So as far as more writing goes, I think I've really put a lot of focus on the deeply mystical aspect of the core of the book. And now I'm going to have a little bit more on this idea of, how shall I put this? I first encountered the idea that you create your own reality when I was reading the Seth work, which was channeled by Jane Roberts. I started reading that in 1980, started reading Seth Speaks. And in there we have Seth saying, you create your own reality. Now, I talk about this at great length in the book, but I don't have many free essays yet on the website, so I'll create some of those. But basically, my point is this. That idea that you create your own reality, in my opinion, is very true. Your core beliefs are reflected and become your experience. I'm talking about your inner experience. And yet this idea was distorted, in my opinion, and I'm certainly honoring other people's opinion, that this idea was distorted into the idea that you can be, do, and have whatever you want. And this is a very outer-oriented posture. It's very popular. It sold millions of books that embrace this idea. So I'm a little cautious about this, that you cannot create a three-bedroom, two-bath house simply by thinking about a three-bedroom, two-bath house in your mind or repeating it or visualizing and all this. But the important thing is to know that you can be a kind, loving, peaceful human being in all moments and be focusing on the inner experience, no matter what the outer experiences are presenting themselves. And so this brings up the idea of your core beliefs. If you have core beliefs that you don't fit in, then you want to examine that belief. How well is that belief serving you? Can you try another belief? And this is actually something that I've been doing in recent years for me, because after decades of all this spiritual work, I still had the core belief that I didn't fit in. I fit in a little bit over here in this one little place. But now I decided, you know, why not open it up? Why not say that I fit into the world in a beautiful way? I fit in the world in a beautiful and loving way, and see what that brings for me. So I'm looking for beliefs that are not serving me well, core beliefs that are bringing forth both a new experience, an inner experience, but also new outer circumstances, which is probably reflected in my move to live with my mom down in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And that's a big step in that respect. Have you ever lived in LA before?
You
or
know,
in a huge, large city like that?
I've lived in Santa Barbara for 45 years, but I grew up in this area of Los Angeles, which is right near the LA airport, all through grade school and all through high school, so 12 years. And then I came up here to go to school. But when I was down there, I was younger, and I rode my bike to high school, and I walked to grade school, didn't have a car, so I don't really know LA. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a new thing, and I am a small town guy. Mm-hmm. A big city like this is kind of a gulp.
Yeah.
You know? Fear of the future, a little bit for me, you know? But I'm also excited about the opportunities. There's a lot of people down there, and they may resonate with my teaching. And also, it's going to be very good to be with my mom, who's been alone. And so we'll be together, and that'll be good for both of us.
Yeah. Well, you're still about as close to the coastline as you can get. And so maybe if you start feeling a little hemmed in, just go west.
Yeah.
Until you can't go west any further, and then you just see the expanse of the ocean and maybe a sunset or two, and remember that, this is what it's like to have wide open spaces.
And where we will be is actually still pretty beautiful. When I go for walks, lots of flowers, people are keeping their gardens nice, and I definitely stop and smell the flowers. And I've been, you mentioned one of my essays, The Loving Heart of Enlightenment. I've actually committed this to memory, and I say it every day when I go on my walking meditations. It's about 3 pages. And if you really want to know quickly whether or not my work is appropriate for you, just take a look at that essay, and you'll find out whether or not this resonates with your soul.
I'm always intrigued by the various practices that people have. I mean, you're talking about, you know, walking, and there's, I'm sure, a meditative aspect to that as well. I've never been a meditator of a structural kind of meditator. I've always tried to sort of live by the words of, I think it was Teresa of Avila, who says that God is among the pots and the pans.
Oh, absolutely.
And in my case, it's among the consoles and the computers. In that, what I am doing, I like to think that I'm living out my life's purpose, at least at this moment, and that I'm just going to allow myself to the very best of my ability to be guided through each step along the way and trust that, you know, it's all going to be fine, you know, that I'm going to be where I need to be. That's one of the things that I have found in my career especially is that I seem to have always been in the right place at the right time. In spite of the fact that, and I've shared this before, in the year 2000, I was laid off from 4 jobs. The first 2 times, I went to the unemployment office to fill out the paperwork, and within 2 weeks, I'd gotten the next job. So I didn't get a check. So the third and the fourth times that I was laid off, I didn't bother going to the unemployment office, because what was the point? Because within 2 weeks, I'm going to get another job.
Yeah. And how much of that is happening because of your direct hand? Not so much. God is working through and bringing things, and you have your role to play, saying yes to this and yes to that.
Yeah, and that's the key. I have to say that is a huge key, and that is the saying yes. Because when I look back on one job in particular that I took, which was working within a multi-level marketing program company, it was on the inside, and this was back in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I look back on that as much fun as I had, they eventually shut the thing down after I had quit. And this was several months after the fact, but I had quit my radio job to go do this, and within a few months, they'd shut the program down, on top of the fact that it was also the time, it was May of that year, when I was served with divorce papers. Guy walks in and says, is Richard Dugan here? And I said, who's asking? And served me with the yellow envelope, and I actually was able to muster up a joke, even at that time. Oh. I said, well, you know, this gives a whole new meaning to the phrase Mayday, you know, as they would do in the military. Mayday, Mayday, we're going down, we're going down. But, you know, it all seemed to have worked and flowed forward and so forth in such a way as that I'm here in Santa Barbara now. And we're here doing this interview, and we're having a great time doing what we're doing in the Santa Barbara area and getting to know people and doing little projects for folks to get their message out. That's been my biggest concern, or my biggest focus has been, if you've got a message that you need to get out, if I can help you to do that. And I learned this lesson at the religious station. I didn't agree with every single programmer who came in the room, because everybody had a different twist on the philosophy, right?
Of course, absolutely.
But my focus was, I want people to be able to hear what you're saying. I don't want them to be distracted by extraneous noises or sounds in the audio. I want them to be able to hear every single word so they can make the decision for themselves, and not because, well, that sound is just awful. This guy's got to be terrible. I don't want to have anything to do with this message. When in fact, if they'd really been able to hear it and not be distracted, they might have thought, oh, that's very interesting. I'm going to need to check into more of that. They can decide not to do it later, but at least now they've had the opportunity to hear it. And again, it's like that smorgasbord table. You know, we don't undercook or overcook anything that's on this table any more than we have to. We hope everything is palatable, but that doesn't mean that everything is to your liking.
Yeah, and what I noticed that when I was younger, I would look for a spiritual teacher or whatever, and if I found one thing I didn't like, I would turn the whole thing off, you know?
Yeah.
And I realized that wasn't serving me very well at all.
Yeah.
Why not take, like you said, a choice, a smorgasbord? I like this, I'm passing on that, I'm going to take this.
Yeah.
And so there are things that you might hear soundbite from any spiritual teacher, whether it's me or anyone else. You may hear a soundbite that sounds 180 from what you believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll find that same teacher will actually present that same concept 180.
Yeah.
Because there are sometimes two different perspectives that can be very beneficial. Like, for example, we talked about the Serenity Prayer. And some people would classify me as a non-dual teacher. And they would say, what would a non-dual teacher be doing promoting a prayer that starts off with God grant me, as if there was some type of separation? But the value here is that there actually is validity to the perspective from the many, just as there is validity from the perspective of the one.
Yeah.
They both work. And when you recognize that, you have a lot more functionality. You don't always speak from the absolute.
Yeah.
You know, I can ask you, did you go to the beach today? You don't want to respond, I am the one source awareness that goes nowhere. That's not functional. That wasn't what I was talking about, but that is your true essence.
Yeah.
But I was asking about Richard. How are you doing today?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, what's going on for you? So make sure you always have this functionality and this love.
And
that's
the
two things.
And I'm going to share this because I think it's appropriate. I know that we all have our different views and opinions of our present leader in the White House. And I got sucked into the campaign in September of 2016. And I fought like hell not to, because I had no interest whatsoever in anybody. I was disgusted with everybody.
These are the choices?
Yeah, exactly. I'd rather vote for Jell-O. Okay, let me. My choices are between Jell-O and pudding. Okay, Jell-O gelatin or Jell-O pudding. I don't care. Jell-O's going to win, but Jell-O or Jell-O pudding. And I got sucked in, and it took me 6 months to get unsucked, so to speak, or get back out of it. And the way that I got out of it, and now I don't listen. And when I hear, I turn it off because I don't want to get in the quagmire again. The way I got out of it was I had to acknowledge that this teacher taught me something very valuable. Mm-hmm. And for me, the lesson I was taught was that that's not the way I want to behave. Mm-hmm. And if I had behaved that way as a child, my mother would have over and over and over again slapped me across the face. Mm-hmm. Without exception. My father might have you ever had that experience or seen it maybe in a television show where the father, he doesn't hit the kids, but he pulls his belt out of the belt straps. You hear that sound?
Yeah.
You know, you're going to mind or I'm going to spank you with the belt. Okay. That's what would have happened to me if I had behaved that way as a child, as this teacher is behaving as an adult, as a 70-plus-year-old man,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Thank you for teaching me that lesson. And then I've turned him off.
Yeah.
And I don't listen. Because I've also learned that it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't.
Your inner state is what matters.
Exactly.
And if you pay attention to that and it agitates you, one thing you can do is step away from paying attention to that.
Yeah.
Now, if later you have a little more, I'm not sure exactly what the word is, but then you can bring it back and without that agitation going.
Yeah.
You know, I don't pay much attention to politics and I don't watch the news and all that, but I'm house sitting right now. And so I have access to Ken Burns, the Roosevelts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm watching about Theodore. And he also reminds me of our current state of affairs. Theodore Roosevelt is very strong-minded about what he wants to do. And he does some beautiful things, and he does some things that make me a little uncomfortable, you know, and it's a package deal.
Sure.
I can't cut the guy in half, you know? So anyway, we work on what we need to work on or what we feel drawn to work on and make sure we do it with a kind heart. And this goes for also the prison systems. Yeah. If we bring in people, you know, and we bring them in with hatred and we treat them badly and, you know, what's that going to do, you know? But when you respect them, if they know that you respect them and they know that they don't belong in society running free because they engage in highly disharmonious behavior, it's appropriate for us to protect our society.
Yeah.
But we don't want to put them in jail and hate them. Yeah. We want to respect them and help them become better people.
And all these people that we're talking about, they're on their respective paths, just like we're on ours.
Yeah.
And there may be people who are observing you and I and saying, oh, yeah, fooey on you. You guys are nuts.
Or we got to get rid of these guys.
Exactly. So we may be in exactly the same boat that we might be putting these other folks that we're observing, you know, in that respect. And so now it's like, okay, let's just take a breath here and let's understand that we're all on the same path here. We're all working to try to be better people. And that may or may not be true. I mean, it may literally not be true. But if we take that perspective rather than the other of they don't deserve to live kind of thing, you know, I mean, because that doesn't get us anywhere.
Well, what really is interesting about that is when you have that thought that that other person not only doesn't deserve to live, God should condemn them to hell right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Who goes to hell right now? You do.
Yeah.
Because that hatred burns within you, and that is a hell for your soul.
There was a great line from a one-man play that James Whitmore did, and it was Give 'Em Hell, Harry. And the scene, as I recall it, and I paraphrase, he is walking with the media on his daily constitutional, and they're chatting back and forth, asking him questions. He's giving them answers and little stories, and all of a sudden, you don't hear it's a one-man show, so you don't hear the reporters asking the question. All of a sudden, you hear him say, wait a minute. I heard what you said. No, 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 no. I heard what you said. Now, wait a minute. Let me tell you something. If there is, and of course, very racial period of time in which Truman lived, if there is a black man in the gutter, there has to be a white man in the gutter to keep him there. To your point, we go the very place that we condemn others to. And we injure ourselves when we hurl injurious epithets and vocabulary and thoughts at others. That's just the dynamic. That's, you know, what comes around goes around, karma, even from physics, you know, equal for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. That's just what happens.
Yeah.
And if we are mindful of that, maybe we'll be a little more mindful before we spew out in thought or word or deed, because it's not going to be pretty when it comes back. And I've seen, I don't know if you've ever spent any time on YouTube looking at some of these videos. They put together these instant karma videos where they show people who they've done something. They'll show what they did, and then all of a sudden it comes back on them.
No, I haven't seen those, but I can imagine that there's a...
It's humorous, but kind of sad, too. Yeah. It's like, you know, if you hadn't pushed that grocery cart up that hill and then turned your back on it, it wouldn't be coming back at you and knocking you down.
Yeah.
I mean, just a loose example.
So what we want to see is the cause and effect relationship between your core beliefs and your experience.
Yes.
And so this is something that each of us can dig into on their own and show to yourself whether or not this is going to hold water for you.
When you put this particular book together in particular, what was the, from your perspective, what was the impetus that you felt it was necessary to lay this out? I mean, obviously, we've talked over the years about all of these different aspects, and it was only a few years ago that I really heard the story of Buddha and his epiphany at the Bodhi tree, realizing that if I stop looking for it, I'll find it, kind of thing. For you, what was the impetus for you putting this work into writing?
And let's just put a fine point in what you said. If someone says, if I stop, I'm going to find it, if there's still some urgency about stopping, they're not going to find it.
Oh, good point. So, good point.
So anyway, I was, I have been around channeled entities quite a bit in the late 80s. Used to read channeled books. And then I finally said, you know, I'm not so sure I can find a human teacher that I like. So I'm just going to keep reading these books and whatever. And it seemed like some of my friends were interested in what you might call the New Age.
And beautiful people.
Oh, yeah. But I wasn't quite seeing things that way. And one day I was just walking down Upper State Street and I saw a friend of mine, beautiful Russian woman, and hi, how are you? And, oh, you know, I'm going to get some tea, and then I'm going to go to Timothy Conway's. And I said, well, who's Timothy Conway? Oh, he's a spiritual teacher. And I'm like, you know, one more spiritual teacher, you know. Where is he? Well, right here. You know, she's Russian, and so she would use phrases that were a little different, like up in the mountains. What she really meant was up in the foothills. So San Roque, you know. And so I go, all right, it's right now? She goes, yes, it's right now. And it's free? Let's see. It's free. It's right now. I'm here. Okay, I'll go.
Why not?
And so I go, and Timothy is about my age, and he's just very gentle. He doesn't make a big deal of himself. There's no spotlight. There's no drum roll. He just speaks in really calm ways. And he had some spiritual experiences when he was 16. And so he woke up to that. He has a very good aptitude for foreign language. So he jumped into studying Buddhism and Hinduism and traveled and, you know, went to India and met Nisargadatta, which is a famous teacher over in India who passed away shortly after Timothy visited with him. Anyway, I said, you know, I don't really get what he's saying right now, but I get a good feel. And so I'm going to come back next week. And then I came back the next week. And then I realized, you know, I think I'm going to come back every week. And I came back every week for 11 years until he moved out of town. And as he laid this often called non-dual wisdom on the table, I started to digest it in different ways. And I had already been a spiritual writer. haven't really gotten much traction with it, but I started to have these influences come into my writing. So then I had these essays that I said, you know, maybe I can integrate them together and bring them together and make a book out of it. I didn't really know what was required for self-publishing and all that kind of stuff. But eventually I researched it and learned how to do that. And so that's how the book came together.
Hmm. And you've obviously you've revised it over the years because you've put out later editions.
Yes.
The most recent here in 2018.
Or right. late 2017. February, actually, I think it's the second revision of the second edition. And it's noted in the copyright page. It'll say February 2018.
Ah, okay. And so it just seems to me like maybe what you have there is something that you just, you'll get some new insights into some of the sections, and I'll revise that and we'll put that out next year or what have you, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's always a good thing. I was able to finish my book, at the end of 2017, the last week thereof. I had made a promise in January of 2017 that I was going to finish my book. So I did, the last week of the year. Now I'm in the process of that self-publishing kind of thing, and who to listen to, and what advice to take, and you know which path to go down. Oh, I should go to that website, but they told me to go over to this website and do it this way.
Turn left, turn right, go straight.
Yeah,
don't go anywhere. Back up. Go up, go down.
I. It's funny because you make me think of this observation that I made of. For example, of regulations here in California, I say, okay, you're on a chessboard. You're standing in the middle of a chessboard, and here are the rules. You can't go forward. You can't go back. You can't go to the left. You can't go to the right, and you can't go diagonally, and you can't stay there. Those are the regulations in California,
yeah.
Whatever it is. And sometimes that's what happens in our lives is like, I don't know what to do. Yeah. You know, I don't know how to levitate yet. So I can't just levitate off the board and go away. It's the whole process that I refer to as searching. And as I shared with you before about how I'd shared this with someone who said, well, when you find Jesus, your search is over. And so, no, it's just begun. And I continue to search. And I use these programs as both a learning experience as well as therapy, because there are times when I will have psychotherapists on and we'll talk about different subjects and maybe I'll get a little insight into self, because really that's part of what we're all about is better understanding who we are. So not so much so we can better understand everybody else, so that we can understand our interaction with everybody else and have, shall we say, a better presentation than what we had yesterday with the same situation, only this time we're not going to have a reaction. We're going to have an action that is different than a reaction and bring about maybe a more positive outcome for, you know, whatever it happens to be.
More polished.
More polished, exactly. I've heard it too. I've heard it said too also that that once you have that all those people who have passed on, they had it right at the end there. They got it. Okay. Because if you've got it, you don't need to be here anymore. I mean, that was sort of the philosophy.
You might want to stay and help or come back and help,
Know. Well, and we can all, and I think that's another element too, is there's that analogy of a ladder.
Yeah.
And you have someone above you who is helping you. Mm-hmm. And you have someone below you, you are helping them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it's about. That is the community that we're working with.
And community is a good thing. And it's not all about me, you know.
No.
I mean, it's like, I've gotten it, so I'll see you guys later. Good luck with yours, you know. Yeah. It's not like that. It's like, and
we're going to be taken care of like the lilies of the field.
And my mentor was very much embodying this.
Who was your mentor?
Timothy Conway.
It was Timothy. Okay.
Timothy Conway. And Timothy was very much the spiritual friend. He'd be like always available, you know. And I would simply go to the Tuesday night meetings. I didn't hang out with Timothy in a lot. He was very busy with other things. But Timothy is very knowledgeable, has an extensive website, enlightenedspirituality.org, and there's a dash in between those two words. But Timothy Conway, yes.
Mm, interesting. So I want to thank you for sharing your time and your story with us. And I'm also curious, before we do wrap up, about where you are today as compared to, I mean, you had mentioned that that you were born and raised Roman Catholic.
Yes.
How has that juxtaposed to who and what you are now, say, on a spiritual level, and, say, maybe the relationships that you have, hopefully, with family members and friends that you had back then? That community relationship.
This could be a long story.
That's
because,
right.
I mean...
We're good.
When I was first, like a little boy, 3-4 years old, I had this understanding. I remember having this experience. It wasn't like I was looking over the shoulder of my body, but there was something that told me that I was more than just my body. There was more to me than just the little boy Thomas' body. And so from there, when the formal Catholic teaching of that you have a soul, that was really easy for me to go into because I already had this intuitive understanding that there was more than just the material world. And I really resonated with all of this love that was in the church that my family went to. I have a big family, and it was a really good community, and a lot of boys and girls, all the kids played with each other and had lots of fun, and it was really, really good. And then about the time I was 18, 19, 20, I started to have deeper questions that didn't seem to fit with this Catholic upbringing. I didn't know what or where to go. And so I just dropped it and went without any real teachings or guidance until I started reading those Seth books in 1980. Now, those books had come out earlier. I wasn't reading them when they were first being released. I had only recently found them. And this brought the idea that there is more than the physical world and that there is this connection between what you hold as your core beliefs. I like to say your core beliefs are the DNA of your experience, your inner experience. So I found that to be a fascinating presentation because Seth puts the idea that each and every person is having this unfold for them in an exact way that works also for the group. And so I thought, well, this is really interesting. Now, as I discovered this, it's like, how do I talk to my brothers and sisters that notice I'm not going to church anymore? My mother and father, my mom goes to church every day. She still goes to church every day as we speak. 85.
You'll be joining her when you move down to LA?
I won't be joining her to go to church, but
I'm sure that's okay.
I support her in this because it works so well for her.
If it serves you, do it.
It works so well for her, and it's a beautiful thing. And one of the saddest things about the particular church that we're talking about here, it's so close to the Los Angeles International Airport that when I was a kid, it was a vibrant community. But the LA International Airport expanded and intruded into this parish and condemned many homes, and those homes were torn down. And that was the home that I basically spent grade school and high school in. So as that intruded into the parish, the number of people that are attending the church has gotten much, much less. Yeah. And so the vibrancy that used to be there and so obvious is much diminished. So it's something that she has seen because she's been attending that church since 1961 when our family moved into that community. So to see that be so strong and then get weak because of just the shift, the intrusion of the airport into the area has been a little hard for her. And also, go ahead.
What do you think about the mysticism within the church?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. It's almost they have to have these beings that wake up to these ideas that God is creation, you know? Mm. It's not just that God is going to save certain people. God is everything. And in this understanding is a certain type of salvation. These people, I haven't studied them, so I can't speak to this. Timothy Conway would be very helpful in this regard because he's very studied in many, many disciplines. So I can't really comment on that. But I do know that there have been some mystics that have stepped forward in various different traditions, not just Catholic mm-hmm. or Christian.
Oh, yeah.
There's Jewish mystics, and, you know, it just goes on and on. And so some of these people that really wake up to this, they end up giving you a message that you've heard before. This is all about love,
yeah.
you know? And it's like, oh, where have I heard that before, you know? And what does that really mean? And you know.
Well, one of the things, too, is, and my wife and I were actually talking about this just the other day, that sometimes you are going to hear that same message over and over and over and over and over again
yeah.
from so many different sources. But until you hear it from one particular source that maybe you'd never heard of it before from, suddenly it clicks, which frustrates the bejeebers out of the people who've been telling you this for years, going, we've been telling you that for years and you're just now getting it? And yeah. I remember a conversation with my brother out in the desert once. We were at a family reunion outside of Coolidge at the Elks Lodge, I think it was, and we were just walking, and I was sharing with him where I was at and on and on and on, and he says, well, God, you're, and I think I was 33 or 34 or something. He said, man, it's about time you got it. I said, Mike, it's not when you get it. It's that you get it.
Yeah.
Okay? I could have been 133 and just getting it, and it still would be okay.
And these awakenings actually continue to unfold.
Oh, yeah.
It's not. It's kind of like waking up in the morning. When you wake up in the morning, it isn't an instant on. There's a reorientation. Oh, yeah.
yeah.
You know, I mean, and these spiritual awakenings, sometimes this deepening, this awakening deepens and deepens, and it takes years or even lifetimes for these to unfold. So some people are expecting, just tell it to me. I'll look at it with my cognitive mind. I'll get it, and I'll turn on, and I'll be this enlightened being.
Yeah.
It may not work like that. Yeah. Timothy had some very profound experiences when he was only 16, but there was a lot of deepening. My awakenings much later, and it is still deepening.
This is not Timothy Leary, folks, okay?
Yeah.
And in terms of, because you had mentioned this before, do you channel?
No.
You do not, but you have been amongst folks who have.
In the classic sense of channeling, where a person will have their soul leave their body and another soul come and start speaking and using their vocal cords. No, I don't do this. But I do tune in to my higher mind. And so a lot of these ideas that are in the book, I'm tapping into that. But it's not like I'm channeling my
right.
higher self, or I wouldn't use those words. I would just say that I'm inspired.
Right. That's a good word for it. You know, I mean, it certainly takes away almost a stereotype in that regard that can put some people off.
Yeah,
it's like that fellow that channeled the Apostle Paul
mm-hmm.
to explain his explanations mm-hmm. from the epistles. You know, I'm sure that he ran into a little some roadblocks along the way because it was quote unquote channeled, as opposed to maybe rephrasing it and saying, "Well, I wrote this down. I'm thinking Paul might have said these things. This is my impression."
Yeah, this is my impression.
And sometimes we have to do that. And it's not that you're lying. It's just that the message is what's really important.
Yeah.
And we do tend to get lost in the messenger.
Oh, the messenger gets highly checked out.
Yeah.
Or chucked out.
Yeah.
And so it really is about the message. And sometimes it can come through someone you don't expect. You know, it just, or it comes from the sky or the trees or the river going through or whatever.
We just don't know.
It's just like, whoa, this whole thing is me, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, wow.
People can go to infinitelymystical.com and they can investigate, they can check you out and find out what you're all about in that regard. They can also go to the same website and take a look at, and maybe even go through to Amazon.com. Pick up a copy of Living the Paradox of Enlightenment, Spiritual Awakening in simple, clear English. You have one in simple, clear Swahili?
No,
I'd understand that much better.
The funny thing is about that is that my teacher, again, is very good at foreign languages, so he can talk as Buddhists talk and as Hindu talk, and they use a lot of Sanskrit and Pali, and you know, and I don't have that skill.
Yeah.
So I talk in simple, clear English, I hope.
Well, before we let you go, I want to ask you three final questions that I ask of all of my guests. I'm hoping that we do get an opportunity to chat again. It would be interesting, I think, too, to see how your adventure has progressed after you have lived in Los Angeles for a period of time, because obviously that's going to be quite a transition. There's no question about it. But as you say, you know, it could be really good because of the folks that you may come in contact, like-minded community, and that would be a wonderful thing. We've always, and we always look for that. We had that in Phoenix, and it was wonderful, and we moved here to Santa Barbara, and we haven't, there's other reasons behind it, but we never really have found a community that we could be a part of like-minded individuals. Certainly there's Unity, and I know there's the Spiritualist Church we've attended a few times over here on, I think it's on Garden Street.
Yes, it is.
We have been to a couple of others, but nothing quite like what we had in Phoenix. And obviously I was born and raised there, and I was there for 46 years myself. And really enjoyed that. And we actually did have an experience where every month we would go to this one woman's house where she would channel the way it was phrased, the entities that called themselves Equinox. Mm-hmm. And they would speak on a specific topic. And then you'd pay your entrance fee of like 10 or 15 bucks, no big deal. And then you'd get a little ticket and you could ask a question of yourself, of a situation, whatever the case might be, and Equinox would then give you the answer. I still remember once when I was approached, or when I was, my turn came, and before I could even get a word out edgewise, she says, "Why aren't you at the ocean? You should be there already." She says, I'm working on it. So it's, to me, the experiences we've had and the people that we've come in contact with, and yet we've touched certain lives here in this community. Out in the valley, we met a gal who used cards, and I had a great conversation with this woman in regards to, for example, my dog, as well as my relationship with my wife, as well as my job situation, and all these different things, and just kind of putting them all together into sort of a space that, hey, it's all working well. Everything, you just kind of have to hold on. And I keep saying that, okay, well, I know there's transition coming, and I know that we want to do this and that and the other thing. I'm just waiting for the universe. Well, you know, when we moved from Phoenix, the universe moved rather quickly. I lost my job, and 4 months later, my wife quit hers, and we decided to come here to do some reconnaissance for a week, as well as take a little vacation. And then literally within 2 months, the house was sold, and we were on the road across LA into Santa Barbara. So, and that was a situation where, and you kind of alluded to some of this earlier, where everything that I had learned up to that point, and I still learn, acknowledge to this date, that when you find yourself on the edge of a precipice, as my wife put it on March 1st of 2006, I said, I've learned that when you come to the edge of a cliff or a precipice, you do two things. You jump and you trust. Mm-hmm. And we did. And boom. So I'm doing the same thing now. I don't know what to do right now other than what I am doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to continue to do that until I'm given direction to go a different direction. But hey, I've put it out there. Yeah, I would love to do this or do that or do the other thing. I just need to know what's in my best interest. What's part of my life's purpose? You know, I think my wife would be frustrated if the universe actually came out verbally and said, well, you know, his life purpose is actually to stay here for another 20 years. You know, who knows?
In the moment.
Yeah, so it's living in the moment. Let me ask you, in the moment, who is Thomas Rossetto?
Boy, that is a... I am someone, I'm a helping hand. I love to help people find the love and the joy that's within them and help that unfold more.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
It doesn't matter whether I find a large audience or a small audience. The important thing is for me to be genuine and to have really big ears and listen to the people that are around me and to see if I can help them unfold and discover that they themselves have a divine nature.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To live in the moment and to listen to that voice. And to come forth with love and peace and joy, expressing that.
Thomas Rosetto, thank you so much for taking this hour with us here on the program. I've really enjoyed it, and I do hope that we do get a chance to talk again, whether it's before or after. And maybe, like I said, I'll jump on the train, which I absolutely love to take, come down to L.A., and we'll get together again and have another chat.
I'd like that. Thank you, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.